So I think that the liberty of the lockdown has now evolved and segued into the tyranny of incarceration, I'm sure Foucault would have been right behind the whole business of incarceration.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, I'm just going to pour myself. You got anything on the go? Because I've just got. I'm just going to pour myself a little bourbon, actually.
Oh, that looks nice. No, yeah. I'm just drinking tea today.
You know what? I have drunk so much goddamn tea. And again, I think that's, you know, it's part of that blitz spirit. You know, we should have an urn, like a big old urn.
Yes.
Yeah. And it should be constantly brewed up.
A little old lady should wheel it round.
Yeah, with like a little, well, like a scarf on and a penny. Yeah. But we're not getting that. We had we did have something. It's really funny, isn't it? I mean, I find this. I mean, I think I was messaging you over yesterday. I found some of the rhetoric around the incarceration somewhat distasteful. I don't know about you, but there's a lot of rhetoric. I mean, in the UK, obviously we had not just the UK. I mean, all over Europe, we had VE Day. And it was all, you know, we went out into the street and there was people there, you know, suddenly just gone back to the 1940s. Mm. Because that's the only time that's when it, you know, that's when you can kind of get behind the idea of kind of European solidarity. So you have to dress up you have to turn it into a pantomime, you know?
Yes.
So you have to enact a previous time. So you've got to dress up it. So there are people out there in 1940s gear, and there was like music, kind of like, you know, people playing, you know, Vera Lynn and that sort of stuff in the street there, and everybody was drinking tea and eating jam and scones and so on. Don't get me wrong, none of those things. Yeah, it is cosplaying European unity. I mean, it was, and there were lots of kind of, you know, nationalistic symbols that were ever so slightly uncomfortable to be sat amongst because they have latterly been subverted by the kinds of extreme nationalisms that we're experiencing at the moment. So,
yeah, I know what you mean. It's, for me, it was like a kind of tug of war, and it's like, it's brilliant. So, you know, we should celebrate, you know, the defeat of fascism and remember all the people who died and all that. But then it kind of just feels like something off about the way it's been celebrated in this way.
I know. I know.
That doesn't sit right with me.
No, it's a weird dissonance, I think, because in the midst of, you know, we're living in a country which, for the most part, seems to, in terms of the kind of the popular support, seems to be rallying behind kind of anti-European sentiment and a more kind of isolationist mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And yet these same people, I'm guessing, were out on the streets celebrating victory in Europe.
Yeah.
You know, we're all in it together and so on. Whereas, you know, I'm sure that for a lot of people in the background, at least at an unconscious level, they were thinking victory over Europe. I found that quite interesting because it does kind of chime with the idea of grand narratives and meta narratives and some of the stuff that we might be talking about over the next few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, just for a second to kind of dwell on that whole kind of cosplay thing.
Mm. Don't get me wrong, I like to dress up.
Yeah. No, I mean,
you're sat there dressed in a very nice Arthurian outfit at the moment.
As usual, which is really nice.
Yeah. And when Vanessa comes to see her, she always dresses up as a kind of some sort of Regency monarch in the kind of the long dress. So, you know, nothing wrong with cosplay, right? Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, so for me, I've had this kind of these moments where I like really getting into, I love watching movies, but I really like kind of periods of movies. So lately I had the kind of a bit of a Charlie Chaplin era.
Nice.
Pre-20s, early 20s stuff. Mm. And you can kind of really jump into it, like, you know, like a bit of time travel.
Yes.
So, you know, you go into the history of these people, you know, where does, you know, Charlie Chaplin's got an amazing history and life and what happened to him. And so it's that kind of, it's almost, you know, thinking about the, you know, the 1940s stuff, it's almost like fetishistic.
Yeah. I think that's true. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I mean, I think that's probably why my go-to viewing when things get kind of, you know, pressurized or stressful, or I'm feeling the need of comfort and so on, tend to be things that from my youth, which call to mind a simpler time.
Mm.
Not just a simpler time in my own head, because obviously as a child, things are much more straightforward. But also just the kind of things that were filmed, and the way they were filmed or televised, just assumed a grand narrative, if you like, just assumed a kind of a, you know, the good guys and the bad guys, and the good guys were uncompromisingly the good guys, and the bad guys were kind of, you know, uncompromisingly and irredeemably the bad guys, and you didn't have to anguish over any of this. It was just kind of, you know, we are rooting for these guys. You know, old episodes of Doctor Who, you know, for example, or older episodes of, you know, Star Trek, or even kind of older depictions of, you know, the Second World War, or any kind of, you know, you could almost just get, you know, it's like team sports. It kind of, you know, you get behind the good guys and you boo the bad guys, and you have this kind of feeling that justice was achieved and right was done and everything was kind of right with the world. But the rest of it, and that's quite comforting. Watching some old, you know, watching some old Gerry Anderson kind of, like, you know, Thunderbirds and stuff like that. I know, you know, it's children's stuff.
Mm.
But you know, here we have, you know, a bunch of, you know, good people spending their, obviously they must. I mean, the Thunderbirds people, you know, the Tracys must have been billionaires.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of money they spent on their secret island with all the equipment.
Yeah.
It must have been serious money involved in that family, but they were spending it all on just helping other people and rescuing other people. And everybody was genuinely grateful for it. And so what great guys these guys were.
Yeah.
You know, nobody was out there. There was one bad guy, but you knew he was the bad guy because, you know, he had a bald head and he was foreign and his eyes lit up. but the narrative was really easy to follow because these are good guys using their money and their power and their resources and their smarts to do good things to help people. And everybody was grateful for that. And nobody tried to kind of rip them off. Or nobody was kind of churlish about it, or said, "Oh yeah, well of course, you know, you would do that because you're just, you know, you're just really rich and you're just, you know, giving us scraps from the table." And it was just kind of, you know, it was a really straightforward narrative.
I suppose these days, if they did it, it's going to happen now, isn't it? There'll be a dark version of it.
Oh no!
And there'll be like the island will be have, you know, I don't know, be some slaves on the island or something, or the money to get their all their money's made out of. You know, it comes from kind of third world exploitation or something.
Yeah, that's where all the equipment was made. And then, of course, and then you get people complaining, oh, well, all that money you spent just on rescuing that boat at sea.
Yeah.
You could have spent all that money kind of educating kind of, you know, the disadvantaged and feeding, you know, feeding the million, starving millions, rather than showboating in your fancy aircraft. and then you kind of go, oh, yeah, you're probably right. Should have, yeah. So anyway, so how are you? You okay?
Yeah, bearing up, I think. I think I've come through the other side. So for a long time, I was having trouble reconciling work with home life because it's basically now work within home life, I don't like that because I like to have work. I start work, I'm working. I finish work, I'm done. Mm. Now it's home, you know, and then I can relax. But that's out of whack now. But I've kind of come through the other side. I feel like I could probably go on doing this, you know, especially if the, you know, once the kids go back to school, then you still then you do have a kind of you have that break that breaks there more, so that, you know, they're around now, so I'm doing work, but I've also got to help them, and that's that's fine, but it's difficult.
Yes. But I get that. It's interesting. I mean, I wonder again, you know, because we will be talking about kind of narratives and representations of the world and all that sort of stuff. And I wonder how something like this, an event like this, kind of global event of this nature, is going to change patterns, whether we're going to see paradigm shifts. For example, will people suddenly have this kind of, you know, Jasperian boundary experience, think, actually, I can work from home, you know, or actually, I quite like being at home. Maybe I'm going to completely jack in the kind of the boring sort of office work I've been doing, wherever it's been. And I'm actually going to work from home. I'm going to find a way to make that function for me.
Yeah.
And where the kind of big corporations are going to start saying, actually, we don't need infrastructure.
Yeah.
We don't need all these huge buildings. And, you know, people can just kind of work where they are through the net. And you know, that will save us a huge amount of money. Maybe we can increase people's salaries a little bit, yeah. Keep even people a little. I mean, those probably won't. But I mean, it is interesting to see how because as we talked about, Carl Jaspers, who's one of my favourite existentialist philosophers.
Mm.
We've mentioned how he talks about boundary situations and how it's almost a kind of conscientization, kind of, you know, almost sort of Paulo Ferreira sort of thing, that you never really know the routines you're in until the routines get challenged.
Yeah.
And then you think, crap, I never knew I could do this any other way.
Mm.
I never realized that, you know, it's almost like getting, you know, kids to sort of eat stuff they've never eaten before. It's kind of, eat this. No, I don't want it. I don't like it. You've never tried it before. No, I don't like it. Mm. But you've never eaten any of it before. Yeah, but no, it's just not part of their worldview.
Yeah.
To eat this thing for whatever reason, and then they eat it. They go, "Oh, actually, it's really nice. You know, can I have some more of that?" You know, and I think people are in that moment now of reconsidering a lot of stuff.
That's different. Another reason you can really see that a kind of a different way of looking at the world through the characters, but also through the people, and you compare that to after the war, and there's a world of difference. You know, there's big things are happening, and I think. What we're living through now is a little bit like, you know, like when we had 9/11 or whatever. After that, that was a change. There was a shift. And there's going to be a shift now. But obviously, to try to be is a tough one. But this is this is where philosophers come in. I think this is where people who think can really give us kind of some illumination.
Yeah. Mm. And I don't think it's even a level of constructing another narrative by saying, okay, you know, now this is really the way we should be living, because that's constantly been the, in my view, been the kind of the mistake of political philosophers and even, you know, revolutionary kind of thinkers, that that idea of the enforced utopia, that you know, okay, we're going to clear the decks now, we're going to have, you know, a revolution, so the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and then we're going to put in the place, once we've cleared the decks, we are now going to put in place our replacement narrative, you know, our new way of seeing the world, and that inevitably will involve a degree of coercion. And there will be various groups that will be disenfranchised and so on. And it seems to me, and I don't know whether you agree with this or not, but it seems to me that the job of the philosopher is to take that kind of Kantian route. So you're going to have the courage to think for yourself. The decks are cleared now, or some of the decks may be cleared now, or there may be some space or room to manoeuvre. Recognize that. Recognize you can actually negotiate. You can move things around a little bit. Mm. Take this as an opportunity to rethink. You know, it's that. You know, and you can hear the echoes of so many philosophers kind of saying that in the back of all their kind of formal kind of structures, the things they actually want to teach people to do. There's always that moment of that kind of will to power. Take responsibility for changing things up a bit. I say this, I'm the world's worst at this, you know. I take the kind of, you know, Wayne's World sort of, you know, we fear change kind of approach, because I'm always convinced any change I initiate is always going to be a change for the worse, and it'll be too late.
Yeah.
Go on, carry on.
No, yeah, I feel the same way. I think it's age as well.
Possibly.
Because
yeah.
You're getting older.
I was always a bit like that. Go on.
No, when you're younger, then that's why it's somewhat dangerous, isn't it? I think we were talking on Messenger earlier. You talked about 1968 and the students. It's dangerous, but it's also like, you know, the catalyst there for any kind of change. But it's also change be dangerous. And when you get older, I feel like you feel like you've got more to lose.
Yeah, in that change. Better the devil you know kind of mentality, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it is that. I mean, there is that. I think partly. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff. Again, we'll get into this more formally as we progress. But you know, a lot of it is tied up with kind of local narratives. I mean, it's kind of Foucault talks about this. You know, it's very difficult to kind of go back to find an origin for anything. This is where it starts, because there are so many things that influence the way things are seen and perceived. And I'm sure, you know, the way I perceive the world is conditioned by any number of things. You know, the people I used to play with as a kid, the toys I was given, you know, the flat I grew up in, the smells that surrounded me, my grandmother. I mean, not just the big things, like, you know, my dad left home when I was 10, or that kind. I mean, those sorts of things obviously have an impact on you. Mm. But it's a lot of the other things as well that kind of help to condition, you know, your own local narrative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I said this, that sort of fear of change, I think is something that kind of, I think you're right, it hits us as we get older more, because perhaps we have more to lose, or perhaps we're just used to things and we feel less we feel more out of control.
Yeah, definitely,
in the midst of change. And I think if you've got more time ahead of you, then you can always think to yourself, I can, you know, I can always bring this thing back into line, I can always kind of regain control over time. But the less time you have in front of you and the more time there is behind you, the less opportunity you have for kind of taking the wheel and keeping and getting things on an even keel again. So, but I think it is the kind of the philosopher's job in moments like this to just say, you know, almost, so now what?
Yeah.
So now what? You know, this has happened. It's thrown a lot of, as Jasper says, boundary situation. It throws your life into sharp relief. Things that you thought you knew, things that you thought you couldn't live without, ways of doing which you thought were the only ways of doing. All of these things are now up in the air. What do you want to do? I mean, you might want to go back to the way things were, and there's nothing wrong with that. But you've got the opportunity now to reflect on that and to choose, perhaps, you know. It's like I was talking to my nephew the other day. We were having a chat online, you know, he was saying, you know, because, you know, it runs in the family, that, you know, the men in my family tend to you know, start to lose hair fairly early on in our illustrious careers.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to that point where you have to decide, you know, whether you want to hide that with a variety of conjuring tricks with hair, or whether you just decide to lean into it as if it was a will to power. You've decided to grasp the baldness, and you just shave it all off.
Yeah.
And my nephew, God bless him, is on the borders there, and he said, you know, I might just shave it all off. And I think, well, you're in lockdown now, you know, nobody's going to see you. Do it. Give it a try. You know, you've got you can change things up while you're here. Shave your head, look at yourself in the mirror, see if you like what you see. See whether, you know, it might be the making of you. You might increase in confidence. You know, you might find that, you know, that your you know, your gender of choice might find you that much more attractive. It might, you know, it might open up a whole new world for you when you actually get outside.
Yeah.
But, you know, now's the chance to try it. When I mean, I grew a beard when I was in a kind of a lockdown situation when I was a youngster.
Mm.
And I thought, I'm going to grow a beard now because nobody's going to see me.
Yeah.
So if it looks stupid, or if I just think this is not part of my self-identification, yeah, I can change it.
You've got a chance to change, yeah.
So I think that's like why going to university is an interesting thing, or moving away from where you live. Because, like it or not, we're always part. We're always part of a local narrative, which becomes aggrandized. And even though, you know, in the postmodern scheme of things, the grand narrative is that kind of big story which explains everything. And the local narratives are the smaller stories which just explain your present context. Those local narratives can become your grand narrative if you're not careful.
Mm-mm.
You know, your tribal gods can become, you know, cosmic or, you know, all-encompassing gods, and they prevent you from doing things you want to do.
Yeah.
And prevent you from becoming the person you want to be, or enacting your own unique self-identity, what you actually want to identify yourself as. And so you limit yourself because you think, people are going to see me, people, you know, I am in the public eye here. And if I try and change the way I look, or the way I speak, or the way I think, or the things I do,
yeah,
people are going to judge me, and they're going to say, well, that's not you. And you can say, well, maybe it isn't me.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I can remember what before, and I remember writing a letter into our local newspaper in Jersey, so it's hardly big time. Mm-hmm. And it was about, I think it was something about politics and about, you know, local politics. It was, and it was all very Ponzi and self-aggrandizing. But I might have even mentioned this before, and I can remember going to visit my grandmother, who also lived in Jersey, to for some reason or other. And she said, "Oh, you know, I saw your letter in the local Jersey Evening Post." Mm. I said, "Oh, yeah. What do you think?" And she said, "So who wrote that for you?" Because in her mind, there was no way I could, people who write to newspapers in a kind of fairly lucid style, those are a particular kind of person, and that wasn't me.
Yeah.
So I couldn't possibly have written it. So in her kind of narrative, that didn't fit the schema. And I had to wait till I went to university before I was able to kind of like, you know, dress in black, you know, grow the full-on beard here, and actually kind of act like some sort of Ponzi intellectual before anybody would, you know, would accept that as me, because they didn't know anything else. They hadn't got anything to compare me to. You know?
Yeah, but now you look at stuff you've written 20, 30 years ago, and you think, who wrote that for me?
You know, you read my PhD, didn't you? Yeah, dear.